Good evening. My name is Herb, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Herb.
Hi. Welcome to our 12 Traditions workshop. Please join me in a prayer for an open mind. God, please set aside everything that I think I know about myself, my brokenness, the 12 traditions in you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my brokenness, the 12 traditions, and especially you. This is the foreword to the pamphlet, AA Tradition, How It Developed, by Bill Wilson, published in 1955. How shall we AAs best preserve our unity? When an alcoholic applies the 12 steps of our recovery program to his personal life, his disintegration stops and his unification begins. The power which now holds him together in one piece overcomes those forces which had rent him apart. Exactly the same principle applies to each AA group and to Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. So long as the ties which bind us together prove far stronger than those forces which would divide us if they could, all will be well. We shall be secure as a movement. Our essential unity will remain a certainty. May we never forget that without permanent unity, we can offer little lasting relief to those scores of thousands yet to join us in their quest for freedom. It is the purpose of this workshop to review and discuss each of the 12 traditions so we may better understand and apply them to our fellowship and to our personal lives. Please join me in a few minutes of meditation on that intention. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We are here to talk about our second legacy, unity, and to review the 12 traditions. Crosstalk is allowed in a loving and supportive manner. To be informed and helpful are our only goals. Somebody Googled some information here about what does Alano mean. We had some discussion about Alano Club. So where does it actually, that word, come from? It's obvious that it's a contraction of words, Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was interesting that the first clubs were called Al-Anon clubs, because it was the contraction that they came up with, Alcoholics Anonymous, and they called them Al-Anon until 1951, when Lois created Al-Anon, the family recovery program. And so they made a recommendation that the names of the clubs be changed from Al-Anon to Alano, which is kind of interesting contraction. Let's see. The dash in the Al-Anon, A-L-dash, capital A-N-O-N, name was included in part to distinguish the fellowship from the existing Al-Anon clubs. November 1987 issue of the Al-Anon periodical. All right, so the assignment was to do with Tradition 7, and the short form: every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The long form: the AA groups themselves ought to be fully supported by the voluntary contributions of their own members. We think that each group should soon achieve this ideal, that any public solicitation of funds using the name of Alcoholics Anonymous is highly dangerous, whether by groups, clubs, hospitals, or other outside agencies, that acceptance of large gifts from any source or of contributions carrying any obligation whatever is unwise. Then, too, we view with much concern those AA treasuries which continue beyond prudent reserves to accumulate funds for no stated AA purpose. Experience has often warned us that nothing can so surely destroy our spiritual heritage as feudal disputes over property, money, and authority. Well, we spent last week's discussion talking about Tradition 6, which was all about property, money, and authority, as well as some other words that they used in the short and the long form of the tradition. So the primary principle here, that as I discerned it in my preparation for tonight, is corporate poverty. And what they mean by that is that we want to cover our expenses and have a prudent reserve. We'll be talking about that tonight throughout the evening. Cover the expenses and have a prudent reserve. So no real excess wealth. That's really the whole point here. Because they wanted to protect the unity. Keep in mind, each of the traditions is building safeguards for the unity of the group and AA as a whole. So Tradition 7 supports Tradition 6, because Tradition 6, as we made major comment about last time, is that each group is a spiritual entity. That was in the long form. Each group is a spiritual entity. And so they wanted to distinguish between a spiritual entity and a material entity, and maintaining our primary purpose, which is to carry this message, the spiritual message, the message of a spiritual awakening. Avoids materialism, was the comment that I made in my notes. In the same way, we've been comparing steps 7 or the respective step to the tradition. And in here, I saw that step 7 acknowledges creator reliance. If you recall, step six was identifying our character defects and really seeing underneath that we're powerless over our character defects, yet we're fully responsible for our behavior. We're powerless over the source of the defect itself, but we're responsible for how it manifests in our life. And we resolve that by saying, we pray because we're powerless, and that's the invitation to step 7. And we hold ourselves accountable to somebody because we're human and we're responsible. I don't think it's any accident. It's total speculation on my part that Bill used the 7-step prayer, starting with the first word, my creator. Because he saw in the step 6, the character defects, the substructure of our very being needs to be changed and we're powerless over it. So we ask the divine creator to come in and recreate us. My creator, I am now, etc., etc. So as step 7 acknowledges creator reliance, tradition 7 also does the creator reliance. We're relying on providence. That is a benevolent universe. We're going to maintain our expenses covered by our income and a prudent reserve, because that's what responsible humans do. They set up a reserve, and we'll talk about what does that mean. Short version of it from my standpoint is it's really up to the group. The material from General Service Office says 1, 2, or 3 months could be a prudent reserve. General Service Office themselves have set up a 1-year reserve of their expected gross expenses for the coming year. So in the ASO, I'm not sure what their annual budget is, but I think it's something like $8 million. You might know. George does. There you go. So let's assume that it's an $8 million budget. They would have a reserve, a prudent reserve of $8 million. If the worst thing happened and no additional monies came into General Service, they would be able to handle staff and expenses for another year. And we'll be talking more about that. Lois made a great comment, and some of this is just as I done the reading and the reflection. These are either direct quotes from the reading or my comments that came from my reflections. Lois said, purse strings can become ropes that hang us. I love that phrase because you really get the feel of it. The uncanny, unfortunate connection of money to personal and family chaos, and I'm sure you've all seen that.
Lois said that?
Yes, Lois said that, yeah. So we have to ask ourselves, at least I put down my reflection, do I contribute a little extra for those who can't contribute? We make it very clear that this workshop is not about money, and yet we do have expenses, our rent and photocopy and whatever else. We have expenses to cover, and we target $5 a person to do that, and quite frankly, it's really incumbent on you tonight to think that way with the group as small as it's become. Last week, we were a dollar short in overall making ends meet. I'm not concerned about it because in the past, we've had a little margin at the top. So I'm just sending out the message. It's very timely that we're talking about Tradition 7, self-supporting. Thank you for participating with laughter. All right. But the point is, it's not about money. And so if you can't afford to contribute, don't, please. If you can, please do. And maybe if you can contribute a little bit more for those that can't, that sort of balances it out. That's kind of the socialism of our meeting. So the question Tradition 7 really addresses is poverty versus wealth. Now, we're not talking about actually being poor, all right, having an $8 million budget, if that's the thing, and having $8 million in reserves. I mean, that's clearly not poverty. But what it is, it's the spirit of non-attachment to the accumulation of unnecessary and excess wealth or materiality. Please.
On his traditions sheet that you gave us, the principles, this one actually says actual poverty for 7. Do you want to modify that?
No, not yet. No. This is Noel. He's from Monday night. He does the same thing down there. He's very active. He's engaged. I just love it. It's wonderful. But the answer from my standpoint, and Bill goes to great length in some of the literature to talk about St. Francis of Assisi. I mean, that's relevant today since the new pope, you may have followed it, you may not, of the Catholic Church took on the name Francis because he wanted to send a signal to the church, certainly, that he's embracing poverty, non-attachment to wealth. And quite frankly, in his case, non-attachment to the old ways. He's really trying to bring in a fresh breeze to a rather stale environment in Rome. No other comments. But Bill, of course, was writing this in the late 40s. And he's bringing in the image and name of St. Francis of Assisi. I have to conclude that it's because of his relationship with Father Ed Dowling. Father Ed Dowling, who he began his association with in 1940, November 1940, when Ed Dowling had read the book and said, "This is a marvelous spiritual book," and he wanted to identify who wrote it and whether or not he, Bill Wilson, was aware of and acquainted with the writings of St. Ignatius of Loyola. St. Ignatius of Loyola started the Jesuit Society of Jesus order of Catholic priests back in the 12th or 13th century. That's why they're called Jesuits, and focused them on academic scholarship. So they became the academic elite, the Green Berets of the academic world, in the Catholic world anyway. And so Ed Dowling comes from that tradition, and the founder, Ignatius, had created his own, the Exercises of St. Ignatius. And I have had a complete year study in that, which parallels almost, you know, down the road with the 12-step methodology. So Ed Dowling saw this and he wondered. He said, well, maybe Bill had read and been exposed to. And Bill said, "Ignatius who?" exercises what? And this guy was so relieved because then he knew of the authenticity of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which had its own methodology and its own vocabulary. So Bill engaged him at that point, 1940, as his spiritual director for the next 20 years until Ed Dowling died in 1960. Now, the point of that is the powerful influence that a Jesuit Catholic priest had on Bill Wilson. It's clear here where he quotes St. Francis of Assisi in the seventh tradition, but he also is very clear, as I pointed out in the step workshop, in step 11, where he uses the St. Francis prayer as a model of what we call Lectio Divina, a particular method of meditation, as well as in step 4, inventory in the 12 and 12, where he uses the seven capital sins, a totally different model than he uses in the big book. So he was pretty impressed with Ed Dowling, and he was pretty impressed with the spirituality of St. Francis, who espouse poverty, I mean real, actual poverty. I won't even go into his story. So the one thing that there was in common in terms of the writing as I saw it, and I just loved it, that the one place that spirituality and money mix is in the hat. You know, and this is 1940. Men wore hats, especially in New York. It was cold. And so they didn't have baskets. Somebody took their hat and they passed the hat, literally. All right? That's what that phrase means, exactly. Now, that's very much in contrast to what we've heard in tongue-in-cheek, of course. You know about the golden rule, right? Right? You know about the golden rule? The person with the gold rules. Well, yeah, I said it was tongue-in-cheek. But not so much, huh? And Bill clearly says throughout this material that's one of the reasons that AA will not receive any major contribution from any alcoholic. They won't receive any contribution from a non-alcoholic, any contribution at all from a non-alcoholic. But from an alcoholic, they will only receive a limited amount per year, not any major contribution. And so once again, because he doesn't want anybody to have that kind of influence over policy or procedure or behavior. And, you know, when people make large sums and contributions, they want their names on the building, they want to interfere with the board of directors, they want a special consideration for their nephew. And, I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on. Right. So there was a comment, I love this comment, a bank balance sobriety. So this is all in the spirit of self-supporting now, all right? So we're going from money now to sort of a spiritual, sort of a soft area. Bank balance sobriety, there's a reciprocal relationship. You may have remembered in the fear inventory, I talked about a reciprocal relationship, the teeter-totter effect. To the extent that I have fear, I don't have trust. To the extent that I have trust, I don't have fear. They're not mutually exclusive. Fear and trust reside in us at all times. But to the extent that we have trust, we don't have fear. To the extent that we have fear, we don't have trust. Reciprocal teeter-totter relationship. And it's the same with the in the area of finances. Do your feelings vary with the size of your bank account? Do you feel good and secure if your bank account goes up and not so much when your bank account goes down? It's natural. It's very human, absolutely. Challenge yourself. How much am I relying on a benevolent universe? How much am I relying on providence and trusting in God? Doesn't mean that you don't have to work and be prudent and diligent. It does mean that overall, you take responsibility, you make the effort, and let the bank balances fall where they do. So trusting self and money versus relying upon God, that reciprocal relationship again. And I was reminded of step 3, the promises of step 3 on page 63. Anybody have a big book? I didn't bring mine. Anyway, it says at the top, to the extent that we rely on God, who has it? May I have it?
Sure.
Page 63, I don't want to misquote it. It says, being all-powerful, God provides what I need. It doesn't say God provides what I want. It says God provides what I need. But there are two conditions. If I keep close to God and perform God's work well. In my step workshop, I interpret that for us. Step 11 and step 12. That's how I keep close to God, meditation, step 11. And step 12, that's God's work for me. That's my destiny, is to be a channel of the message, practicing spiritual principles and having compassion for all of humanity, but especially in our own fellowship. Being all-powerful, God provides what I need if I keep close to God and perform God's work well. Thanks, Dave. So the purpose of and the theme for corporate poverty, again, I just recapped it here, is so that AAs would, otherwise AAs would not feel responsible for supporting the organization. Let's assume that AA was independently wealthy and had a great treasury. You know, it'd be very hard-pressed to get people to contribute whatever it is we contribute as the basket goes around. It's hard enough as it is. You know, less than half, I think, of George, you might know this, less than half of the groups in the world contribute to general service. Say it again.
And in this area, it's 29.1%.
It sucks. It's approximately 29.1%. Thank you, George. In this area. I mean that's pathetic. Now, it may be that the groups aren't handling it correctly, but my suspicion is that the people aren't handling it correctly. And if, in fact, AA were independent, the trustees would be more involved with money and diverted from the primary purpose of guiding the organization. And if, in fact, AA were independently wealthy, the General Service Office may not pay so much attention to the members. It's kind of like, we don't need your money, so we don't need your advice. And so for all these reasons, it's a wonderful operating principle that we cover expenses and we have a prudent reserve. Okay, I'll get to the rest of that in a little bit. Now, Nicole, I didn't want to be interrupted. I was kind of on a roll. Did you have something that you wanted to mention?
Well,
yes. Oh, yes, please wait. Good, thank you. Good. All right, so let's go to the assignments. John?
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Is it on?
I don't know. The light will show.
There you go. Hey, how's it going?
You're on.
Good. I have an insight about that LA thing, which is that, and it's very much related to what he's concerned about here, is we see 3,000 meetings, and it doesn't feel like there's an urgency.
All right. So there are 3,000 meetings, and John is speculating that there doesn't seem to be an urgency. About what? About making a contribution?
Yeah, it just feels like the bills are paid.
And the point of that would be what?
Well, 29.1% going to central office. Compared to other communities where there are much fewer meetings and much more of an ownership of, if we're going to make this thing survive here, we have to chip in.
Okay, I don't know exactly what the 29% actually represents. So okay. My suspicion is, however, that people are not keeping up with the times with regard to a contribution. And, of course, we'll handle this someplace in here, but it's okay to repeat it. a dollar in 1950, what would that be today? I remember 1956. I was 16 years old working in a first job at a gas station as a service attendant. Yeah, it was called gas service stations in those days. Yeah, I was the service attendant. I washed your windows, right? Filled your tank. 50 cents an hour, and I was glad to have it. I mean, so today, I wonder what it would be. The Johnny Harris, I may have mentioned this to you before, is a wonderful speaker on the traditions, and he says he has solved the inflation problem in terms of the basket. So he doesn't have to think about inflation adjusted from 1950 to 2014. He puts in the basket the price of a drink. All right? Oh, yeah. I was at dinner. I may have mentioned it. I was at dinner the other day, and a couple of people had just the house wine, right, in a glass. $12 a glass. I thought, whoa, I'm so glad I'm not drinking. That was sort of the least reason. But anyway, yeah, but $12. I mean, so I don't put in $12 in a basket. I have adjusted since Johnny Harris talked. All right, at my home meeting, I put in a substantial amount every week. And at regular meetings, I put in just a little bit less than that. I go to two or three meetings a week. And so, you know, just think about responsibility. And I don't know whether it has anything to do with the bills being paid or not. It's kind of like my responsibility, because then we'll talk about it later on in terms of the distribution of the money. Some goes to general service and et cetera. We'll be talking about that. So let's go to Language of the Heart, page 85, written in June 1948, published here as part of the Grapevine articles. Anybody have any highlights on that page that they would like to talk about? Please, Michael.
Michael, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
On 85, we thought we could do a lot of good with other people's money, but we found that kind of money too hot to handle. Mm. It aroused unbelievable controversy. It simply wasn't worth it.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, it does cover some of the inflation adjustment that we actually just talked about. By the way, you know we're being recorded. I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but not as formally. So if you don't want your name up there, you better tell me in advance, because I call you up by name. And yeah, I just realized that. And but you don't have to speak, or you don't have to give your name, unless, of course, I've already betrayed you.
Linda Coda Al-Anon. In that first paragraph, sober we now have it, drunk we would not. Even if drinking isn't my thing, to be dependent on other people for their approval and so
right.
on,
yeah.
For me to plunk in more money gives me a feeling of completion, self-satisfaction.
Responsibility.
A range of emotions.
Yeah.
For me to decide to plunk in more than a dollar and to see people going, why are you giving so much? I it's this whole world
yeah.
in it for me of contributing
yeah.
more than
yeah.
a dollar.
I actually try to be quite covert about the money that I donate, because I'm not sure that I am sure that I don't want people to actually be aware of that, because it's really none of their business, and I'd rather have it anonymous.
Hi, George Barrel, alcoholic. You know, the first thing I noticed on this page was the date, June 1948, as I was reading, and it said the AA General Service Office now cost us $1.50 per member per year. So I have the current statistics on that. Actually, the 2014 budget is it's $15,300,000.
All right.
And out of that, we keep about $300,000 if we're lucky. In 2013, we lost $600,000 out of $12.8 million.
Yeah.
But the okay, so it says it costs $1.50 per person. So now out of that $15,300, we have reporting about 1.4 million members. Okay. So it's $10 a member now is what the cost is of running the General Service
there
Office, which really isn't too bad as far as the inflation goes, because inflation is much more than that. And so it's talking about how much people ought to contribute. So, you know, figure a factor of 10, you know, to contribute. So if it was a dollar in the pot
that was a year
back then.
I don't want to put out a number. I really don't want to put out a number because it's not about the doll. It's not about the money. It's about the spirit of it. But I like the idea of the cost of a drink. There's something kind of proportionate about that.
And the other thing I want to say is about the spirituality. Parting with your money, your hard-earned money, even a little bit is spiritual. So even if somebody can't put much in, just putting something in rather than passing it because they think a dime is, you know, looks bad. Just putting a dime in is a spiritual experience if you're broke.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
That's
really,
a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good point. Monique?
Nicole? Al-Anon? And I want my money back for enabling all you alcoholics for so long.
Send me the bill. Another one I won't pay. Yeah, really.
Right. Oh, yeah, okay. Anyways, so I like the little line that says become and then thankful givers is in quotes. It's on the very last, on page 86. And Al-Anon, some of the meetings that I go to in Al-Anon, I don't know if they have this in the reading. It's not actually, it's something some of the groups have adopted when they're asking for the seventh tradition. And it says, they say, please try to donate $2, one for yourself and one for who still suffers in or out of the rooms. And, you know, I just, for my own family, like, I have plenty of people in my own family who I would love to see in program. Yeah. So I just think of it like I get to support them and, you know, their name is on a chair. I wouldn't, you know, I'd take my sister, you know, I would bring
them. I have a symbolic thing for you.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. And page 86 did talk about this becoming responsible citizens of the world, thankful givers rather than ungrateful takers. And I love that phraseology. Let's go to the 12 and 12, tradition 7. Anybody have any highlights on page 160? I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, there's lots of wonderful anecdotes here, and I'm assuming you read it, so we're not going to read it. If you want to make a highlight or a comment about it, it'll be fine. We now sober pay our own way, and that's where he talks about collective poverty or, in another place, corporate poverty. But once again, he's not talking about being poor. Number one, he's talking about having a balance rather than excess, and he's talking about not being attached to your wealth or your money, not being attached to it. I mean, I think that's really the source of a lot of people's unhappiness, being attached to it. All right. How about 161? Oh, go ahead.
Noel, alcoholic.
Hey, Noel.
Just a couple of highlights in the first page. Self-supporting alcoholics, we find that's what we have to be. This principle is telling evidence of the profound change that AA has wrought in all of us. And then it jumps down. Time out of mind, we've been dependent on somebody, usually money-wise. And then the beginning of the next paragraph. Probably no AA tradition had the labor pains this one did.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, and they just come out of the Depression, too, so money was extremely kind of, there was a lot of insecurity around it.
Milton Al-Anon.
Milt.
On page 161, we shall have to separate the spiritual from the material. When I first started coming to Al-Anon, it felt really good. And then about 2 months into it, I started thinking it was an occult, and I was thinking, how much money do they want from me? Because that's what I've experienced before in some religions. And so it really emphasized that this is a spiritual program.
Yeah.
And it's just unbelievable. But these steps have actually been making me into a better person. Traditions?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought the traditions were so weren't so spiritual.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is blowing me away.
Well, I'm so glad, and I personally am experiencing that, but I get that comment from both of the workshops, how people are finding this very nurturing to them spiritually and very awakening to them in terms of some of the depth of the spiritual principles.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying the history, too.
Yeah.
And Bill could have sold this spiritual program, and he had chances to, and he didn't. It was God sent. It's just a really good program.
Yep.
And Bill was poor. So, and then, you know, and then he was depressed. So I could understand, you know, the woes he had.
Yeah.
And it's just makes him into more of a person to me.
Yeah.
Which I could understand. And
he was a man of principle.
Yeah.
He held his principles, even though he lost all of his material possessions. And he and Lois were living on the second floor of a Alano Club. They were living on the second floor, sponsored by the group and AA at the time, because they had lost their house. They had lost, he'd lost his job, of course. Lois was working for minimum salary, and they had really, really, really hard time. John?
Yeah, John Alcoholic, 161, middle of the page. Now and then, grateful benefactors had endowed clubhouses, and as a result, there was sometimes outside interference in our affairs. And related on 164 at the bottom, whoever pays the piper is apt to call the tune, and if the AA Foundation obtained money from outside sources, its trustees might be tempted to run things without reference to wishes of AA as a whole. And I have worked in the nonprofit sector since 1983 and have worked on several campaigns, and it is amazing how the lead donor of the campaign will come in when the project is over and place themselves in the seat of the executive director and say, thank you for your hard work.
Yeah, yeah, actually, very good. Practical experience there.
I on page 161, top sentence, I was taken by this. We were astounded to find that we were as tight as the bark on a tree.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I love the way Bill has...
He's got some great poetry there, huh?
But, you know, that's very interesting. I've been treasurer of a number of meetings, and as such, I often watch very carefully the basket as it has passed, and I see how many people pass it without putting anything in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're the ones as tight as bark on the tree. But there have been a few times where I have made a special appeal for money. You know, one time I said, we want to get a really good literature display here, so please give generously. And another time, I had just taken over the treasury and discovered we were in debt. And when I appealed for money with a good reason, people were very generous.
Yes.
And there were a few times I found people putting $20 bills in.
Sure.
We're not always tight as bark.
No, and sometimes we just need reminding about the issue and the reality and our responsibility.
Justin Alcoholic.
Hey, Justin.
And just on 161, in the first or the second paragraph, you can't mix AA and money. You know, he says this throughout this whole tradition seven. And then the hassle over a chunk of money played havoc for years. Frightened by these complications, some groups refused to have a cent in their treasuries. Somebody gave a little bit of money and they were fighting over it. And I've seen the group fight over over just the littlest thing. And I can't imagine what they would do over money.
Yeah, I can.
You know?
I can.
And I know from my own experience that money usually screws everything up. And when you don't have any money, people are equal.
Yeah.
And as soon as somebody has more money from somebody else, other people start to resent it.
Yeah.
You know, and it does play havoc.
Yeah. You know, let's be realistic, though. I would rather have the spirit of poverty and be wealthy than have the spirit of poverty and be poor. All right? Really? Seriously? Absolutely?
Sure. I'm Rob. At the bottom of 160, this struck me. While alcoholics would spend lavishly on 12-step cases, they had a terrific aversion to dropping money into a meeting place hat for group purposes. So, yeah. You know, I tried to think, well, why would that be? And I mean, part of it might be compassion. It's hard to see somebody suffering and knowing you can do something to alleviate that, at least temporarily. Sure. But I also think there's ego in that. You know, there's immediate credit, there's gratification, there's prestige. Yeah. You know, whereas just throwing your money kind of anonymously into the hat, being one of many, and you don't know exactly how it gets spent, you get nothing out of that.
Nobody will see.
So yeah.
Exactly. Well, wasn't that Bill's story in one of these readings where Bill had a guy come into the office and obviously down and out, and Bill reaches in his pocket and pulls out a $5 bill. Now, this is in 1945, 46, whatever it was, and $5 might have been a day's wage. Bill just generously, without much thinking, gave it to him, and that night in his home group, the basket was passed, and Bill reached in his pocket, and he felt a 50-cent piece, and he says, oh, that's too large. And so he fumbled around a little more and picked out a dime and put it in the basket. And then during the rest of the meeting, as he was thinking about that, some grace moment, he said, oh, my God. Earlier today, I gave $5 without a thought, but it was because of I felt so generous and... You know, look at me, you know, St. Francis himself. And yet in the basket where it's kind of like anonymous and stuff, and kind of like, woo, and this is the group that saved his life. Yeah, thank you, Rob, please.
I find it interesting to listen to National Finance Committee talk about we have too much of a prudent reserve, we're going to work on bringing it down. And then
for groups?
No, national.
No, the national, okay.
And
for GSO, you mean?
No, I'm not talking about AA.
Oh, you're talking about a particular fellowship. I got it. So I'm sorry.
And then to have someone join the committee and start ranting and raving about the size of the budget and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
It's a perspective, you know, of outrage. And I just say to myself, you just joined and you're outraged.
Right.
And you're not asking any questions.
Right.
I mean, I've been there.
Yeah.
It's very easy to be self-righteous and outraged.
Yeah. And ignorant.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, really, seriously. It sounds like a lot of money to the people who don't know how to manage and calculate and have experience with money. Exactly.
Nicole Al-Anon.
Nicole.
I'm an intergroup rep for one of our meetings, and I get to learn about all the finances and everything. And Al-Anon was in a lot of trouble locally. We had to close our central office one day a week in order to make up finances. We were in the red for I don't even know how many years. And this is what happens when meetings don't donate. And the offices that were able to open at one point to handle money and finances and provide literature, which is really the lifeline to all of these programs, is the literature. When that's not available, that's where we start to get into trouble.
Yeah.
And so being on the other side and seeing what the dollar value actually pays for has given me a lot of humility in my own life.
Oh, yeah.
So thank
you. Well, that's really, many people have expressed how they're applying these traditions and these principles and these conversations to their personal, not just the AA and the group and the general service office, but actually the principles to their personal life and seeing the relevancy of that. And that's part of the juice of this series of workshops for me personally. Page 165, it says, AA must always stay poor, bear running expenses, plus a prudent reserve. So it may be in another area here. Let me see if there is. No, let's talk about prudent reserve. What does it mean, prudent reserve? Anybody have some thoughts on that? Prudent. Does anybody know the definition of prudence? Prudent? Does anybody have a thing and they could look it up? All right, somebody do that, and we'll look it up. We did that last night. It was very, I think, revealing and confirming. So you had a...
I actually had a comment. One of the things you mentioned about having, you know, it kind of doesn't run as a business, but in reality it does. And I've been to different meetings here in San Francisco, and a lot of the meetings when... I go to a particular meeting where they're always asking for additional money, and I know for a fact that we negotiated a price for the space, and then someone individually without group conscience went and talked to the owner, and as a result of that conversation, the rent went up.
Nice.
So they're constantly asking for additional money for this meeting.
Got it.
And when the treasurer's report comes out, it's never an actual report. I mean, I have to admit that I'm a little bit on the left brain on this when it comes to this conversation, but it's sort of like, we didn't make the rent, we need to pass the basket again. Well, the actual amount of the rent has never been discussed. The actual amount of the collection has never been discussed. So when we're sitting in this meeting, it's sort of like this magical moment where we don't, you know, we don't have enough money. And I want to be asked, like, what is the treasurer's report? Is it an actual report? Here's where we're at. Here's our prudent reserve. Here's what we're donating to, you know, central office. And, you know, it's a person that we're actually selecting. I mean, I know, you know, there goes a trust issue again. But, you know, it's a group giving permission to someone with 6 months because they happen to have a job, you know, taking a group conscience and making that person the responsible person.
Now, that's the role now of group conscience. If you have an issue like that with a group, you bring it to the group and you suggest in a tolerant way, you suggest that we have a group conscience to discuss this and get the kind of report that you think would be appropriate. Right.
So, but there's actually not a standard AA report, so it's difficult to say that every meeting is not.
Every meeting
donating.
Will have an accountant in it, I'm confident.
Yeah, they have one, but there's not a process.
And they can always call George.
Yes.
And he didn't hear that.
Noel, alcoholic, prudent, acting with or showing care and thought for the future. No prudent money manager would authorize a loan without first knowing its purpose. Synonyms: wise, well-judged, sensible, politic, judicious, sagacious, sage, shrewd, advisable, well-advised. Alternate definition: shrewd in the management of practical affairs, i.e. prudent investors, marked by circumspection, discreet, provident, frugal.
All right, so there's a bit of a range there, but most of it's about common sense and planning. Dave?
Yeah, my dictionary has prudent, showing carefulness and foresight, avoiding rashness.
Avoiding rashness. There is the balance again about common sense. Yeah, thank you. Okay, let's see. And it's about making financial, on the last part of 165, making financial independence part of its tradition. Alcoholics Anonymous has revived an ideal that its era had almost forgotten. And he's writing this, of course, in 1948. All right, so let's go to the Traditions Illustrated. Yes, Justin.
Attention to on that.
Oh, we got a couple more here. Yeah, please.
Page, which is, you know, it mentions the principle of corporate poverty was firmly and finally embedded in AA tradition, you know, after discussing this. But then, you know, it notes something pretty important, which is, to people familiar with endless drives for charitable funds, AA presented a strange and refreshing spectacle.
Yeah.
And this was really one of the things which made AA special. That it just wasn't like other groups.
Yeah, was it Bill Alexander, Bob Alexander, whatever?
Jack
Alexander's article. Jack Alexander had investigated the rackets on the New York, you know, harbor scene, and he busted it up. So they brought him in to take a look at this new cult that was emerging, because there was something fishy about this. All right. And the one thing he was impressed with is they just would have nothing to do with money or fame, personal aggrandizement. And he was incredibly impressed with that, wrote the article that basically opened up the floodgates, and then he became part of the board of directors after that. He felt so comfortable with it, not being an AA. He was a non-AA trustee. Please.
Yeah, on 164, about an inch from the bottom. Compared to this prospect, the $10,000 under consideration wasn't much. But like the alcoholic's first drink, it would, if taken, inevitably set up a disastrous chain reaction.
Yeah.
That just resonated with the allergy and all of that from the first step.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. And go ahead.
And just the doctor's opinion and all of that that you drilled into us in your other seminar.
Yeah. Well, and so as long as you're bringing that point up, AA has adjusted over time the amount to that they will allow to be contributed by a member, which is $3,000 a year, and that's living or dead. We discovered that last night because somebody asked the question, well, what about a dead member of AA who leaves the $100,000? We can't take it. $3,000 per year, living or dead. All right? So they're just really making sure that for all the reasons that we've talked about, nobody has any special juice.
What about the person in the room who leaves $3,000 in the basket, though?
The group probably will never know it. but so I don't know the answer to the question, but that would certainly have to be dealt with at group conscience, because that's very legitimate. I could see that. I could actually see that happening. Absolutely. Absolutely. The little amends from the drug runner, right?
I had an interesting experience last month with Prudent Reserves. I'm the literature chairperson for H&I, and the literature has its own Prudent Reserve, but the H&I bylaws, we can take from one Prudent Reserve and slide over to the other side either way for things. And the opportunity came up to buy extra books before the prices went up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I didn't do it because I felt it would be drawing too deep into our prudent reserve on literature side. Yeah. And during the policy council meeting, you know, why I didn't do it, I explained that. And it came up that we needed to take some money from the literature prudent reserve and slide it over to the other side. That money wouldn't have been there if I had bought the books.
Oh, there you go.
And the upshot of it was I got some books at a cheaper price because they were slightly marred.
Oh, yeah.
So all things worked out, but if I had done what was I initially wanted to do was grab all those books now.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been able to do what had to be done later.
And the lesson I'm hearing is I operated on principle and it worked out.
Yeah.
And it's been my 100% experience with my sponsees. I say to them, "What is the principle?" And always take the high road. Oh, my God, they hate that. All right. First, they don't mind finding the principle. Do we always have to take the high road? I said, no, you don't. But there are consequences. You know the drill. Choose your consequences, right? It's never failed me once in 26 years since I've done this work. Find out what the principle is, operate on the principle, and always take the high road. And that's what you did. That's right. Thank you. All right, let's take a look at the illustrated. The Pied Piper is loud and clear there. It's not hard to imagine money being the great seducer. Anybody have any highlights on there that they would like to bring to our attention? Please.
Katie, alcoholic.
Katie.
And a number of other things. But John D. Rockefeller Jr., an early friend, said, "I'm afraid that money will spoil this thing."
Yeah.
Now, if anybody would know about money and how things got spoiled, it would be a Rockefeller. So he knew what he was talking about.
But, you know, it's always fascinated me. I don't know the Rockefeller story at all. But this man who had this kind of money had that kind of spiritual insight that money would spoil a spiritual organization. That doesn't make any sense to me, except that he must have had some very powerful spiritual environment or teacher or life himself, a spiritual life himself. And well, maybe that was it, too. You've seen the... I deal with a lot of adolescents in recovery, and a lot of them are trust fund kids or from the blue blood families, and they've never really had to think about money or responsibility, and they're 25 years old and they're in their fifth treatment center or 10th even. It's just pitiful, and they have no living skills at all, no sense of reality, because they've been protected from it by well-meaning but enabling parents. Somebody gave me a definition of enabling versus support. It'll come back to me. Today, it was just today. It'll come back to me. All right, so there's another pamphlet which I haven't passed out to you because I just came across it this weekend, and it's called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix. And according to Bill, he says, the answer is simple enough. Every single AA service is designed to make more and better 12-step work possible, whether it be a group meeting place, a central intergroup office, or the World Service headquarters. That's the purpose of the money, is to support the carrying of the message. It may not be directly, but indirectly, like the rent paid on a room is very indirect but very important, so that people can come in and get the message, let alone carry the message. He also, in here, it I believe it tells about prudent reserve. He talks about the GSO as 1 year of operating expenses. You want to challenge yourself. I know I have challenged myself. I'm a big believer in insurance because that's where I spent my career, so I have plenty of that kind of conservative support. But there were decades where I never had 1 year's reserve available to me in cash. Oh, my God, that would be just huge. But what a sense of security it would give us if we had 1 month, let alone 1 year, of reserve in case things change in the environment, which they have a tendency to do sometimes. Okay, and then you had something about, yeah, here it is, the distribution, all right? The AA pamphlet suggests the distribution, and I'm sure you and the GSR know these things, that it's hard for some of us who aren't involved in service to remember them. It says 50% to the central office, 30% to the New York General Service Office, 10% to the area committee, and 10% to the district committee. That's how the excess over prudent reserve gets distributed. In our group conscience, we do a quarterly distribution. We get a treasurer's report that's quite specific in terms of the cost of that particular meeting, the income for that particular meeting, and the balance, and then the accumulated balance. And when it gets to a certain point, excess of the prudent reserve, then that gets distributed on a quarterly basis in some type of formula. I don't think we follow actually this formula. They have a different formula. But the group gets to decide what the formula is. Yeah. This is just a percentage of the distribution when the group is going to make a distribution, whether it be monthly, quarterly, or annually, doesn't make any difference. But when it does make the distribution, that was the percentages. 50% to the central office, that's your local group, 30% to GSO, the national or international, 10% to the area committee, and 10% to the district committee, which is a recommendation. It's just a suggestion. The group gets to do what it wants to do, of course. Going back to the illustrated, do we have any other highlights or comments that we would like to make about from this material?
No.
Please.
Now, Mike, I'm an alcoholic.
Yes, Yes, Mike, you are.
Heard about me, huh? So Elvis had a twin brother, and he died. What would have happened if somebody kept that brother alive? Maybe Elvis wouldn't have been Elvis. And when I read this, I think about sometimes meetings got to close.
Sometimes meetings got to close.
They go away.
Amen.
And if you try to keep it alive, you're going against God's will.
Yeah. It kind of tickles me when I hear that in a meeting. We need support. We need support. Really? Really? I mean, my first thought is, who cares? I'm sorry. I mean, if you can't have a meeting that can function on its own, it should close. Because it's not offering anybody anything. I've seen meetings wither and die. And they should have. Either for poor leadership or there was a competitor meeting down the street that actually had a much better way of doing things. Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
You know, along that line, as soon as we become active in a group, we learn how many expenses are involved in making its meetings effective. Then our horizons broaden. What about that intergroup or central office that so many of us call to ask for help? I've been to so many meetings that should wither and die because they're small and they're in a place that the rent is way too big, and they refuse to move.
Well, but are they able to support themselves? Wait, if they can support themselves, then they just are fine. It doesn't matter how they're doing it. Yeah.
The question.
Oh, well, we're going to pass the basket, so you know the drill. I certainly don't have to make any more announcements. All right. Richard, please. Yeah. Yeah.
It is completely 100% full. The occupancy is that room is full.
Yeah. So the landlord doubled the rent. They either wanted you out or they had bigger expenses than the room was supporting. Sure.
Yeah.
Or a church, whatever. It's just a business. Yeah.
Does fully self-supporting mean making a quarterly chip in to central office?
All right.
GSO.
Now that's a really new but really wonderful question. And your thoughts are?
Well, I'm kind of harping on this tonight, but rents are high in Los Angeles. There are monies being spent on things here that are not being spent in other places. And I think it's the reason why the amount of money that LA and Southern California is sending outside of Southern California is so low has to do with this sort of, you know, we've got our eyes set on making sure that the meetings here survive.
Yeah.
And not really thinking about, nor...
As Al-Anon would say, you may be right, John. Oh, that's wonderful. You know, we have to have a sense of humor even about ourselves. Yeah, really, it's great. It's good. All right, so let's move on. In the AA tradition, you have this booklet. It's the same. I just have an older version. They have an entire section, if you're interested, on money, and it's page 23 to page 30, I think it is. So I scanned it. It was worth reading. But we're talking about a meeting is a spiritual space. Well, it makes total sense. They use the phrase here. If it's a spiritual entity with a spiritual message, that's a spiritual space. And I like that concept. Let's see if I have any other highlights here. We may pay well for special services, but never for straight 12-step work. All right? And a lot of treatment specialists and therapists get a little... into some murky water here, and where they are in recovery themselves, and because they love to finding recovery and want to help other people recover, they get their certifications, they get their education, and they do it professionally. But because they're working 8-10 hours a day in the business of helping other people, they are real tired and they say, oh, I've been helping people all day. I don't need to go to my meeting tonight. I don't need to sponsor people. All right? And of course, if in fact you're helping people and being paid for it, that's not 12-step work. That's not service. And so there can be absolutely no confusion. If you're being paid, it's a career, a job. If you're not being paid, it's probably service, depending on, of course, your attitude about it. And let's see if there's anything else. No, that was all I had in there. But don't overlook the brochures that we did pass out. I did that for a reason. This is the one, and now the more current cover, because it has some wonderful information, and it's not in the order of 1, 2, 3, 4, like that. So you have to kind of like scan the table of contents to kind of see what's relevant in terms of the tradition du jour. And let's see if I have anything with the group. No, I had nothing on the group. All right, so let's then go to the questions as part of the assignment. How about self-supporting? What does that mean, AA, at work, personal relationships, family, and friends? Anybody write a reflection that they would like to either summarize or read on question number 4? Please.
Noel, alcoholic.
Hey, Noel.
I said I'm definitely self-supporting in AA and at work and with family and friends, but it wasn't always that way. I surrounded myself with a great crew of codependents while I was out there, you know, to enable my using. And also when I first got sober, to enable my continuing financial irresponsibility. You know, it took me quite a long time to get all that together. When I was out there getting loaded, there wasn't a week that went by that I didn't get 2 or 3 calls from creditors. Where's our money? Where's our money? You know, 60, 90, 180 days past due on accounts and stuff like that. And if you looked at my credit report, it was like, you know, horrible, you know, 400, 390, something like that. If you look at it now, it says I've never made a payment late in my entire life.
Yeah.
And I checked that and I'm into that. And that's one of the things that's one of the gifts that I got from the program and being sober and coming into a place from being completely and utterly, totally financially irresponsible to just being absolutely, I don't pay anything late, period, the end, no matter what. And it's been many, many, many years since I have. So that's a good gift of the program for me.
What's the benefit of that to you?
I can't tell you, know, I had stacks and stacks and stacks of unopened letters because I knew there were dunning notices from everybody from the credit card companies to the IRS. And I don't have that today. That's literally like a 16-ton weight off my back.
So a feeling of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, you know, hey, this is something that, this is not an issue for me today.
Yeah.
It's big time relief.
And how did that happen, though? I mean, that didn't happen overnight.
It happened over years.
What were the primary moving parts and ingredients for that?
For that to happen?
Uh-huh.
Well, getting sober, for one thing.
Got it.
And then continuing to not deal with that issue after I got sober, and then to just get to the point where the pain of it was too much is like, no, I can't live like this anymore. And it was literally like, okay, you know, clear your credit report. You know, you see the signs all over the place and everything. No, there's one way to do it. It's like you pay everything on time for a long time. And that's what I did.
Pay everything on time for a long time.
Exactly.
Yeah, you make a commitment to principle and you operate on the principle a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get any outside help or counsel on that?
You know, I had people suggest things to me. I, you know, in terms of paying down debt, I had people suggest things, you know, pick your one bill that's got the highest interest rate or whatever, pay that off, and then take that money and gradually pay off other things, keep rolling it so it snowballs into the other things. But that was something that I started doing after I got to the point where I paid everything on time for years.
Got it.
Issue was not so much the debt as it was getting everything so that I paid everything on time.
Yeah.
And it's a big change for me over the old ways.
Thank you. All right, so let's go to question number five. How much of yourself, that's it? No. How much of yourself do you invest in each of the following areas? Of yourself, now, we're off of the money and we're into your own time and talent in AA, at work, personal relationship, family, and friends. Question number five. Anybody have a reflection on that? Thank you.
Jason, alcoholic.
Jace.
The traditions workshop has been fun until this one. This one's really challenging on, you know, with the finances. But I'm relatively new to the program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't like it, but I know I have to do it. And so I kind of keep a safe distance, and doing the reflection on and answering these questions, I'm going, it's kind of hit me that I need to carry my weight, you know, and support this group that's supporting me, which means time, energy.
Are you talking about your groups that you go to?
My groups that I go to, you know, I mean, not just money, but like time.
Because you do a wonderful job here of supporting this group.
Well, this one's easy.
Yeah.
I like it.
No, he does. He shows up before, he stays afterwards, and he's meticulous about what he does. It's a real... gives me a sense of peace.
Yeah. I don't want to do that 7 days a week.
Okay, just one day a week will be fine for me.
Yeah. So it's challenging. Like, I've got all these other meetings, and I'm going, and I just want to get in there and get out. And I'm going, And then that means I got to get involved with people. That's another thing I don't want to do.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you know. And so it's had me thinking, you know, just kind of keeps snowballing. I'm like, oh, this is the whole self-supporting concept. This kind of keeps me away from my family. You know, as an alcoholic, I'm always broke.
Oh.
Because I spend all my money on booze and whatever.
Yeah.
And then I don't want to be a burden to people. And so I've always kind of isolated. So it's really challenging on all... Yeah.
And what you're trying to do is find balance here, because it's not black and white, and there's not a formula or a cookie cutter.
Right.
It's about your finding your balance.
Right.
Yeah.
And
it may be that all seven of your meetings don't get equal attention.
Amen.
Or, no, seriously, think about that.
Yeah.
You know, your first obligation is here.
Hi, Kim Al-Anon. So I always thought this tradition was about money, you know? And I learned this in a workshop I took with you, and I heard it, and it resonated, that I'm fully self-supporting for myself, and I'm fully self-supporting emotionally to myself. Mm. And that hit me like a chord, like, that's right. I'm responsible for me, for my happiness, for my emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
So when I think of fully self-supporting and independent, that's where I am in my step work. I have to do that in order to have the balance of emotional sobriety for me, so that I can practice giving to others in a way. I'm learning more about the principles here, participating, contributing, honesty, and unite, and all of these wonderful words that are having more meaning to my relationships. Yeah. But it's based on me fully self-supporting myself emotionally first, so I can give.
Over the weekend, I was also reading some material in psychology. Thank you, Kim, very much. And I came across a new phrase. Well, at least I heard it for the first time really deeply. And it was, if you really want to be independent, develop the center of your gravity in yourself. The center of my gravity in myself. My center of gravity isn't in Dave, because if I put my center of gravity in Dave, then I've got to see how he's feeling, what he's doing, what he wants, what his motivation is, and what he's willing to give me. But if my center of gravity is in here, I can be detached from Dave's feelings and behavior, because he doesn't name me, he doesn't own me, and he doesn't impact me. My center of gravity. And that's what you were talking about. Exactly. It's a great phrase. Please.
Richard Alcoholic. Yeah, just to step on what she was saying. Yeah, it is about being authentic, and it's so much is about being current. Sobriety, you know, any kind of 12-step work is about being current. Current with emotions, current with resentments, current with financially, physically, mentally, just being current in the day.
Yeah. Well, a woman came up last night after this. We had the same kind of vital, vibrant discussion about it. Money seems to do that for folks. But she said, oh, my God. Between the study that she had done on the assignments and the spirit of the conversation in the meeting, she's been divorced 12 years and wonderfully supported by her ex, but she's been so dependent on the money that she will absolutely cater to him and watch and be very cautious about not interrupting the flow of income, which I'm sure is legally done anyway. But she said, you know, 12 years I've been divorced, and he moved on very nicely and has had at least one girlfriend since then. And I've been really stuck because I'm seeing him as my bread and butter, my source. And I think I finally got an inkling that I can be independent of that, you know. So this is a tradition she applied to herself, that she needs to be self-supporting and work it out so that she's not, quote, in a feeling of dependency on him. So please, Nicole.
Thank you. One of the things that I realized in this is one of the principles for me was dignity.
Yeah.
And as the intergroup rep, we're reimbursed for gas and we're reimbursed for the donation that we put in the basket at the group level. And I haven't been taking that. I haven't been going back to the group and getting it. And in doing this work, I came to realize that by not taking that to the group, I'm taking away the dignity of the group to be fully self-supporting.
Oh, yeah.
Because when they created the service position of intergroup rep, they knew that that was one of the responsibilities.
Yeah, sure.
So I just took it upon myself to change that. And so I was really grateful for this work because it helped me see that.
Sure, right. Very good, yeah. Dave. Oh, and that's another thing about the rent. I mean, a lot of churches say, well, we'll give you the room. We don't want rent. You know, really, that's not in the spirit of this thing. We need to be self-supporting. Now, it doesn't need to be, quote, a competitive rate that you would pay at a hotel or something like that, but it needs to be a reasonable compensation for the use of that property that they would be charging other people if they used it.
Yeah, this has been a very interesting discussion for me because I had a completely different take on the self-supporting.
Mm.
Because coming into program, I was always, you know, the John Wayne, do it alone, not being vulnerable. And so through my recovery, I've learned to be dependent on other people at work, in the program, and in my personal life.
Yeah.
And learning how to be vulnerable has been a very different part of my recovery.
Yeah. Well, rather than dependent, there might be a better word, interdependent. Because I see the growth think about child development, from dependency to independent to interdependent. Dependent is the child. Independent is the adolescent and the young adult, necessarily so, but then interdependent as we get some type of a sense of the society and community.
Okay. So, yeah. So when I was writing about being self-sufficient, I said, no, I'm not anymore. I am really working on building connections, asking for help when I need it, giving help when I'm asked to, and just so it was more interdependent than as you described it.
Being a vital component of your community, knowing in the poetic image that we used at the beginning to talk about unity in tradition one was of the body, that this is one body, metaphysically, mystically speaking, one corporate entity, and we're all just cells in the huge structure, interdependent vitally on each other. Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Katie, alcoholic.
Katie.
I'm not sure how to do this. That just brought up, I've done years of work on financial responsibility and value in my life because I overdid St. Francis and always I thought that being poor meant you were spiritual and rich meant you were bad, you know, that kind of thing.
I do, actually. It's a stereotypical kind of,
overdone Catholic sort of, you know. Yeah, and anyways, but so I worked on that for many years and had a lot of dead ends financially because of that until I realized it's a part of my value. But I was just thinking about a conversation I had with my son because I used to give my kids everything, right? Sure. That was part of it. And one of my spiritual advisors said, if God gave you a jewel, would you just throw it away? Mm. And I was, oh my word, no. So it helped me recognize that these are all given and I use them appropriately. But I said to my son, no. Okay. And I do quote Al-Anon a lot because I'm a codependent. And so I had to say, no, I'm not going to pay all this money for you. And I'm crying. Sorry, I can't give you this money. And at the end of it, he said, Mom, it's the best conversation we ever had because I said, you can do that. So it was a real place of knowing that I give people,
that's right.
I gave my kids, you can do that. And of course, now my daughter has more money than me, and I want to borrow from her, but that's another story.
Right. Send her a bill for raising you.
There was something I wasn't really expecting to get out of this, having to do with the principle of poverty,
yeah,
dealing with this tradition. And all of a sudden, when I was doing the writing, I thought about step 12. And the principle of step 12, where we talk about we can't keep what we have without giving it away.
Yeah.
And in that process, we're helping people and we're giving away our recovery. And we're the more that we put out, the more we seem to get back in the way of benefits. And it's like, wait a second, this is the same exact thing.
Yeah.
It's another level of learning. It's another level because if we're really going to practice, I can't keep what I have without giving it away. Well, wow. I talk about that in the spiritual kind of, it's a spiritual thing. But you know what? It's also reaching into my pocket and it's pulling out some money and it's putting into the hat. And that's a tangible thing that sometimes is more difficult to let go of than our willingness to help people on a spiritual level.
Sure.
And it's another level of being able to learn and sort of, it's the more that I give out in that area too, more seems to come back in.
And it, once again, it's about common sense. So, thank you, Alex.
I was looking at the grapevine, if it's okay.
Yes, please.
There's a sentence: "Could I put a little bit more into the basket on behalf of the new guy who can't afford it yet? How generous was I when I was tanked in a bar room?" And I was thinking about that because I've always been very financially tight. And I've always been a saver, and you know, and my dad grew up during the Depression, and I was just kind of raised with that mentality. So at first I wasn't really even like, oh, well, I don't drink, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a codependent. And then I was thinking about how much I spent when trying to influence somebody that I wanted in my life. And I realized, like, in that reading that sentence, how profound I fed my addiction with money. And in comparison to how, I don't want to say stingy, but just in comparison,
you can say it.
Yes, frugal, yes,
conservative,
smart, but it just was one of those wow moments of I have fed my addiction so much money, and just seeing it in that light was kind
sort
of profound.
Of manipulating that way, wonderful. The principles that we've seen in tradition seven then is the individual or group weakness is materialism, greed, and the principle of the tradition is poverty. And I was asked about the actual poverty. I think I will, in fact, take that out because it doesn't belong there, given our review of this. It's more the spirit of it rather than the actual poverty. And then the principle of the step is humility. So one of many, like grains of sand, all right? not anything unique, not special. It doesn't mean that you're not important, because each one of us as a human being is important. But how important am I really when there's 7 billion people on the earth and every 100 years, you know, there's a whole brand new group of people? It's hardly worthwhile talking about. Right. So the individual and group action then is to provide support. We're not talking necessarily about financial support. We're certainly talking about taking care of ourselves and then having a reasonable attitude about making a contribution from our time and our talent to the world around us. And of course, there's lots of other reflections that we didn't get to, but hopefully you've had a chance to look at them, and you can take a look at the grapevine questions. They're always quite challenging, as Kim had looked at them. And then we'll be going on to Tradition 8 next time. And as you know, we're coming into November. The Tuesday of the Thanksgiving week, we don't meet. I exactly don't know the date here, but I will announce the date next week. We're a ways away, but it's coming very close, isn't it? All right, so our respective 12-step fellowships help their members maintain their personal recovery and encourage them to offer to share their recovery experience freely with others who may have a similar problem. This we owe to our fellowship's future, to place our common welfare first, to keep our fellowship united. For on unity depends our lives and the lives of those to come. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, we want the hand of our fellowship always to be there. And for that, we are responsible. After a moment of silence, please join me in the prayer of St. Francis. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it is by forgiving that one is forgiven, it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. Thank you, and don't forget, if you are interested in the meditation workshop, it's this Saturday, and the flyers are on the table. Thank you.